Hey, folks, quick message. You can now hear our show, How Did I Get Here?, along with about 5,000 other shows on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry phone, Palm phone, or your, you know, iPad that you bought at the thing. Say you're at the grocery store, you want to listen to How Did I Get Here? Or, you know, you're stuck in traffic. You can do it. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Unbody.
All right, hello. We have a great show for you today. I'm very excited to bring you this conversation. But before I get to that, let me tell you what I did this weekend. I played a show at Strange Brew here in Austin. Fantastic place. I played a solo show opening for Tony Scalzo from Fastball and his band. That was fantastic, filled with great guys that I love. And Harmony Kelly, who was on the show and who I'm trying to do this band with, me and her and Kathy Valentine, but we haven't jammed yet. I got to get on that. I got to do that and work on that immediately. I'm just writing it down. So thank you so much for coming out to the show, those of you that did. I know a guy, Keev, he drove all the way down from Kansas for the show from Lawrence. Thanks for coming down. Means a lot. Love it. You guys are all really nice. And I slept through the Grammys last night, which is weird. I went to take a nap late in the afternoon and woke up around 10 at night, just after the Grammys. Missed the whole thing. I heard I did not miss much, so I'm glad about that. I got a call from my Uncle Jack today. He told me that everything sucks in music, and it needs to start over, basically, is what he was saying. We need to go back to the drawing board, and we need to start over. So that's his take on it. I don't know. I like music. I'm having a good time listening to music. And I had a good time playing music at Strange Brew on Saturday night by myself. It was fun. The place is great. If you're in Austin or you come through Austin, I suggest going there. They have great people playing there. Susanna Schaffel has been playing there. Ian Moore. They're going to have a thing with Alejandro Escovedo and Charlie Sexton. And my guest today, who his name is Bill Carter. So anyway, great place. Go on down there. Casey Crowley's created a great space. I want to do some live shows there. And I'm getting ready for South by Southwest. Are you guys out there? You guys, anyone coming down? Anyone already in town trying to get it together? I'm thinking about trying to get into the music awards. I need to tweet at me if you can help me do that. Get back there, talk to some people, get some shows together. Lining up interviews as we speak. Got a lot of interviews today, a little bit later. And I guess let's get to today's show. Let's do this.
How did I get here? Lying in the sunshine.
My guest today is the incredible Bill Carter. Now, I gotta say, some people work hard, some people are lucky, some people are really cool. This guy really has it all going on. Between him and his songwriting partner, Ruth Ellsworth, they've had over 200 people cover their songs, including Stevie Ray Vaughan, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, Robert Palmer, the Counting Crows, Storyville, Omar and the Howlers, and Waylon Jennings, and about 190-something more. That's unbelievable, right? So I could talk about this guy forever, but I think we should just get to the conversation. I reached out to him on Facebook, and he's got a new album out called Unknown. I saw that he was doing an in-store, so I reached out to him on Facebook. He got back. He said, yeah, let's do this. I watched this great documentary about him on PBS that I suggest you see. We talk about it on here. And man, it's just a great conversation. He's incredibly gracious and really fucking cool. Here you go. Bill Carter.
When I come to see you, what will I bring? The wisdom of a poet, the color of a dream. And I leave with three roses made from a magazine. Oh, beautiful to me,
listening, any flowers in the spring, in the field of summer, turning to fall, in anything made of paper, that's all.
So let's talk about that song. That's a song that you wrote in response to the West Memphis 3.
Yeah, that's a song that actually my wife Ruth and I wrote.
Right.
And yeah, that's what that song was written for, Lori Davis and Damian Echols, the young man that was on death row, and he was the main guy, West Memphis 3. He was the oldest one. He was the only one on death row. And Lori was a friend of ours, and that song was written for them as a gift, basically. Yeah. Ruth and I wrote it for them for that reason, and it wound up in the soundtrack and in the film. It's one of the only songs actually in the documentary, the actual film, the Peter Jackson film. So yeah, but it was written.
So really, how did you become aware of them?
Well, originally we were in Los Angeles, me and Ruth and our friend Johnny Depp, and we watched Paradise Lost.
Right.
Somebody had given it to us, and we watched it and said, gee, you know, this doesn't look right at all. So Ruth started corresponding with Lori in Arkansas, and
that's the lady that ended up marrying.
That ended up marrying Damien, right? Damien, yeah. And through Ruth's connection with her, got Johnny involved, and because of his stature monetarily and just his name, was able to got involved and helped with getting funds and things together for DNA testing and stuff that costs a lot of money. That of course those kids had none of. And it just kind of snowballed from there as far as everybody joining in and helping, a lot of other artists and things.
Yeah, a lot of people did.
Yeah, Eddie Vedder especially did a lot, you know, and Natalie Maines. And
yeah.
We did some shows.
I was in a hotel randomly when CNN was on and you were there playing with you and Will, right?
In Arkansas?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, whoa.
Yeah, we were doing we did a concert up there. It was mainly Eddie put it on, Eddie Vedder, and it was Eddie and Ben Harper, Natalie Maines, Patti Smith, and myself, and Johnny. It was pretty much that. And George Harrison's son, Donnie, was there.
Oh, yeah?
A lot of others. Yeah, it was great. It was really a good show, good time, you know, and all that, and raised a lot of money for the guys at that time. They were still in prison at that time, so.
Good. I read, like, an article, I think, a few months ago on Damien. Seems to be doing well.
He's doing real
good.
Okay? Yeah, he's great. I mean, I just spent time with him. You know, he was just here in Austin doing a book signing. And, you know, I spent two or three days with him and Lori. Uh-huh. And I'd spent some time before that in Toronto at the film festival.
Right.
Where I saw the film for the first time, the documentary, West of Memphis. But he's doing great. You would never know he'd ever been to prison, you know. I mean, he doesn't have those scars, you know, visibly, you know, mentally or physically, that you would know. He just seems like a regular. He's a sweet guy. He's a funny guy. He's very intelligent. Has a great book out that he wrote. And
what an amazing act, though, because, you know, I saw that documentary, and I didn't think to write anyone. I did think there was injustice, but I just turned off the TV when I was done. It's pretty amazing that you guys thought to speak up and do something about it and reach out. That's a tremendously kind thing.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, when you see something that's just definitely, you know, that is just so obviously unjust, you know, to somebody, and you're able to do something about it, then that's the right thing to do.
Right.
You know, when you're actually able to do it. And in this case, it just took money. I mean, they took these kids, I mean, you think of Damien, 17, how young that is. That's half his life he spent, not in prison, but on death row, which is a real difference than prison. Death row is a whole nother deal. And, you know, when you're able to, and John, like I said before, Johnny being able to actually go, well, I can do something about this. I mean, you know, and we did what we could do with just putting people together. But, yeah, I mean, if you're able, you just do it.
Yeah.
You just, you know, you don't think twice, or I wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I was able to actually do something for anybody. So that's how that went down, and it's turned out great.
Yeah, it has turned out great.
They're free.
So, yeah, congratulations.
Yeah,
well, to everyone.
Well, to everyone, yeah, especially some of the other people, you know.
Yeah. What kind of kid were you? Did you identify with them on that level? Because were you like a kid that might have been misunderstood? Because that was the basic what happened. They were kind of like those kids that dyed their hair black and were gothy and misunderstood. Were you a misunderstood kid?
I don't know if you would call it. I would. I guess you would call it misunderstood in the sense that, I mean, because I'm older than them and I come from a different era. I come from mainly the '60s.
Yeah.
And in the '60s, you know, to be in a band now it means nothing. You know.
Yeah.
Back then, it meant everything. It meant that you were definitely a rebel. You were definitely on the outside.
Yeah.
Everyone's parents hated you, especially all the girls, because we had long hair. I mean, in 65, I had hair to my shoulders, and we dressed like the Rolling Stones, you know.
Yeah.
And we were the big band in the Northwest, and I was the drummer, and all the parents hated you. The cops hated you. Everybody in the military hated you, you know. So to stick to that, you know, you had to really be determined and adamant and just a natural born, you know, resistor of, you know, what was normal in society.
Yeah.
I mean, I only went to the 9th grade. I mean, by the first month of the 10th grade, I wasn't allowed to go to any school, 5 schools. I couldn't go to any of in the entire district. And it was nothing I did that was evil or mean. It was just I liked to have a good time. But, you know, everybody but the authorities thought I was pretty funny and clever. So.
Right.
That's how that turned out. But at that point, I had already started playing rock and roll, and I just said, this is what I'm doing, and I'm still doing it, which is the odd thing. But somehow I actually knew that that was my deal. And it was difficult. It was very, very difficult, you know, to do that at that time.
Yeah. But you still knew that you fit in the world of rock.
Oh, yeah.
And you are, you know, this your new record is there's a lot of quietness. But to me, when I think of you and your music, I think of like rock and roll, like, you know, almost like a descendant of Chuck Berry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Three chords and the truth.
Yeah. And, I mean, well, you know. And that's true. I mean, I love the roots of American music, you know, blues, rock and roll, jazz, bluegrass, country. I grew up doing all of that, not so much jazz, but I grew up on pretty much real strict country and bluegrass music from my father's side. And so I just love the roots of American music, always have and still do, you know, and that's what I do.
Yeah. But what do you listen to a lot of other stuff? I mean, do you?
New stuff?
I don't know, yeah.
You know, occasionally, no.
I don't imagine you have Justin Bieber in your record collection.
No,
right now,
I mean,
iPod,
I hear a lot of stuff. I mean, I hear a lot of stuff just because. I mean, I don't listen to the radio. I mean, I have XM radio, so I listen to all the 60s station and 50s and 40s.
Right.
So I don't listen to new stuff that's out. I don't like the sound of anything, first of all. I mean, even if there's guys I'm sure that have some good songs and stuff, but the sound of it is just, to me, there's so much electronic. I mean, stuff like autotune, I don't even consider, you know, being a part of music, that the effects they use on vocals and things now. But, you know, the sound, I really like a live spirit, you know, to music, to where it's just some guys really just throwing it down, no matter what it is. And I don't hear a lot of that now, and I'm sure there's some out there.
Yeah.
But I don't, if someone turns me on to it, then I get it. But I don't seek it out at all. I mean, I still like listen to the guys I've always listened to. All the 60s pop rock, Beatles, Stones, and everything before. The original rock and roll guys and the blues guys and stuff. So, and the hillbillies, you know. I still listen to that same stuff, you know. I mean, I listen to records. I have a few record players and a jukebox, and I still listen to that. That's how I listen to music. I don't think it sounds better than that.
You don't?
No, I think it just sounds great on a record. I don't like CDs. I mean, I get it that there are and they're convenient and all that, but I like albums, you know, and 45s and stuff. And just to me, that's it, you know.
Yeah. Do you? So let's go back. When you left school and you went on the road, what kind of band were you in? Was it an original, like rock and roll?
No, actually, what we were at the time, we were called the Chimes of Freedom, which is, of course, is the title of a Bob Dylan song.
Yeah.
And we were like a folk rock band at that time. We were like the Byrds. We did a lot of that kind of stuff, and we did album cuts. We didn't do any of the singles on the radio. We were always cool. We went in onto the album and did the songs that weren't on the radio. And so it was that kind of thing. But we weren't real good. You know, we weren't real. I mean, you know, I was 15 and stuff. But I mean, we weren't like real good players and stuff. We could actually, my brother was in the band. Some guys could sing pretty good. But playing wise, we weren't great. But we were cool. I mean, we were so hip with the times. We dressed. We had the long hair, which most a lot of guys didn't. So we worked on a couple different levels. But it was cool. But I mean, we weren't great.
So how long did you stay up there? You were living in Seattle? Is that
the Northwest, actually west of Seattle. Okay. I kind of grew up there. I mean, I went to junior high and then my short-lived high school years. And then I traveled a lot. I traveled the world with a fiddle player named Doug Kershaw in the early 70s. And played in country bands and stuff. And then came here in 76.
Oh, okay. Been here since. So in the time of the kind of outlaw guys.
Yeah, that's kind of why we came here. I came here with a couple other guys. We had a three-piece. I was the bass player. There's a guitar player and a drummer. And we were doing, because I grew up on hillbilly music, when it became country rock, it was like, we were already doing that in the Northwest. My brother and I already had a band. We already knew all the country songs. We were just playing them rock style because we didn't know any better.
Right.
So, I mean, so when that started happening down here, I said, I'll go there. I know how to do that stuff. We've been doing this stuff for years. Yeah. So we came down here and did that for a few years, actually.
What was that band called?
Carter McDonald. It was me and then a guy named Scott McDonald was a guitar player. And we never did anything. We just played around a little. I mean, we weren't popular or anything. No.
Right. No. What turned that? There was a band. Is that when you, did you meet Ruth during that time?
I met Ruth, I met Ruth like a week or two after I moved here.
At Inner Sanctum. I miss that whole corner, don't you? You miss it, like Les Amis and the Mad Dogs and Beans and that whole thing. Yeah.
There's a lot of
fucking
things.
Starbucks and Johnny Rockets.
I know. I know a lot of shit I miss in Austin that isn't here anymore. You know, I mean, a lot. It makes me cry to drive by the Broken Spoke. I mean, just to look at what they're doing around it is like, it's a heartbreaker.
Yeah.
But, Ruth and I was down here, and the guitar player that I was with had been down here before and played with a guy named Jubal Clark, who was a local guy that was really a good songwriter. He wasn't much of a player or singer, but he wrote really great songs. Anyway, he was doing a show in Inner Sanctum. I don't know why. It was like an anniversary they were having and kind of a keg party and stuff. And so I went down with my guitar player friend to play with Jubal. I played bass, he played guitar, and Ruth was a friend of Jubal. And was there. And we met at that gig, and we've been together ever since.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was like that. Yeah, she was going to the university. She was an English major, I believe. Yeah, at UT, and graduated and went and did all that.
What was the first version of Bill Carter and the Blame, or just the Blame, right? That had Ruth in the band?
Right.
And yet, were you guys already writing together?
No, we didn't. Ruth and I didn't start writing together for literally years after that. The Blame, late 70s, when we would play, we had kind of a new wave-ish punk band, I guess you'd call it, because having come from the 60s, and Scott, the guitar player, was here, we already knew that kind of music. We'd done it when it kind of was out.
Yeah.
So we were just kind of doing the same thing, and I was writing all the songs.
Yeah. And say you were the singer, guitar player.
Singer, bass player.
Oh, bass player, okay.
Yeah, still playing bass.
Were you playing everything kind of as you were learning music?
Sort of.
Drums and bass and guitar.
I started on drums and I went to bass and I always played a little guitar. And then I went into learning, you know, things like mandolin and ukulele and banjo and just different things, picking up. Harmonica I always played since the 60s because I did my whole, you know, Bob Dylan thing. You know, I was the guy with the, you know, harmonica rack and all that too.
Right.
And you know, I was into all that stuff too, so.
So what was going on during that time? Like, what was the climate musically in this town? Was it preceded Timbuk3 and sort of that.
It was kind of odd. It was kind of all over the place. There was just kind of a little bit of everything, but nothing in particular was. I mean, when the whole new wave punk thing was happening, that was a big deal on a kind of a small level. There was Raoul's. There was like one club that did that. But then there, you had Antones. This was just blues. And then you had, I think it was Mother Earth still at the time, that was just the rock club. So you just kind of had three or four clubs that had that kind of music. So it was, and nobody was famous or making records or anything. It was just kind of local.
Yeah.
Basically. And it was cool. I mean, you know, it was very cool. And Austin was a lot smaller.
Yeah.
It was a lot cheaper to live here. There was no traffic. Like, yeah. I just went through coming here. And, you know, so it was just more local. There was no kind of outside of here. It was just kind of a local of different kinds of music. And it was cool.
Yeah.
It was very cool.
And so did people started recognizing you were doing shows with like Stevie and Jimmy was playing with you at the time
actually that was a little later.
Sorry.
Because I was doing a deal with this place called Free Flow Productions, and they had
Mark Hallman,
Christopher Cross, Carole King. Jerry Jeff Walker.
Yeah.
And I was part of that kind of stable of writers, artists, and they decided, or we all decided, I was going to make a record. And I said, well, I didn't have a band. I just was writing songs. And I said, well, I know what I'll do, man. I'll just get some guys and make a record. And there were some guys that did sessions for them and stuff. And then I said, but man, I'd really like to have Jimmy Vaughn play guitar, because he's like, you know, I've seen that band. I didn't know them. I just saw the Thunderbirds, and I said, they're so cool, man. They're just like a real, and I didn't know them anything, and they weren't big or nothing at the time. I said,
it's a good get fit him for your songs,
guitar.
You know?
Yeah, and it was perfect. Same, in my first record, he played guitar, and it was pretty much a guitar, bass, and drum record, and kind of rockabilly-ish rock and roll stuff.
Yeah.
And that worked out good, and then we went on to, I think it was after that the T-Birds were making a record, needed some songs, and Ruth and I wrote some, and I wrote Why Get Up and gave them to Jimmy, and they did that song. And
you said on the documentary that I saw on the PBS thing that everyone should probably go see, because it's amazing. It's intercut with great performances. Some of my favorite musicians are playing with you, and it's amazing. But in that thing, you talked about how you were writing specifically for them in that, right? You sat down to write some...
For the
songs that would work in their voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But similar to yours. It's not like you were...
Well, I could relate to what they were doing, and I thought, I don't even know why. So I don't even remember, because I didn't know Jimmy. I didn't know any of those guys, and someone just said something about the Thunderbirds making a record, and I said, man, I could either write or have some songs that I think they could do. I'd never had a song cut before, so I didn't know if I knew what I was talking about. So we wrote three or four songs, Ruth and I wound up getting them to Jimmy somehow, and he goes, man, that song, you know, Why Get Up, we're going to do that song. And I had written it, it was almost like an Everly Brothers style, and then Dave Edmonds produced that record, so he did it the way they did it, which was great. But, so that was the first song I ever got cut, and I think that album sold, I don't know, 3 or 4 million copies.
Wow.
So it was a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and... yeah, and then we just kind of went on to, you know, write more songs that people were doing. Just got a little recognition. And on my first record that I did with Jimmy, I did Willie the Wimp.
Right.
And
yeah,
Stevie,
let's talk about that.
Well, Stevie heard that and said, man, I want to do that song, man. That's really cool. So he did that.
Yeah.
And of course, that was huge. And
well, tell me this. There was a story in that story that you got called by a homicide detective.
Mississippi, I think it was. Yeah, they called and said, yeah, is this Bill Carter, whatever they said. And I went, yeah, is this? And they said, well, this is so-and-so detective in Mississippi. And I was like, whoa. And I said, wow. He said, well, we have some questions to ask you about a song. I said, about a song? You know, it's not every day a detective calls you about a song. But anyway, he went on to just say that there was a homicide, and they'd found a person that was believed to be murdered.
Right.
And they found some evidence that related to one of my songs. And I said, well, that's, wow, I mean, that's really interesting. Because at that time, I mean, you know, I don't know how many songs we'd had cut at that time. Not many.
Right.
So, you know, I thought, you know, I didn't know what to think, because it never dawned on me that a song would wind up having anything to do with a homicide of any kind. And so anyway, he said, yeah, he said, yeah, there was a song that we, and I said, well, what song? And he didn't want to give me much information. And he said, he asked me if I'd ever been there. And I said, no, I've never been there. I don't know anything about it and stuff. And So he finally gave it up, and he just said that they did find the lyrics to Willie the Wimp was the song, in fact. This guy was dead in a Cadillac, which the song is about.
Right.
A black pimp drug dealer in Chicago. And
that you read in the paper.
That I read in the paper that Bob Green had written an article on. I saw it and went, wow, that's good. In fact, we wrote that on the way to the studio doing that record that I did, Stomping Grounds, with Jimmy. Right in the studio, I was writing the lyrics, went in, and I said, hey, Jimmy, check this out, man. And we recorded the song.
Yeah.
But anyway, they found the lyrics and the guy's, you know, stabbed. I mean, laying on the guy's chest with a knife through the lyrics in a knife into his heart, basically.
Right.
And they wondered if I knew anything about that. And it was like, you
that's
know.
Almost like the call. You wonder if that's the call that the Beatles got, you know, when they checked out the Manson murder scene. Like, hey, we need to talk to you about some songs you got over here.
I'm sure, because you never know. There might be some kind of connection with somebody you know.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But, you know, songs are weird things. I mean, they bring out strange, you know, I mean, I don't know how many. I've had a lot of songs recorded by people at this point. You know, over a couple of hundred artists have done our
songs. That's
a
unbelievable.
Lot of people. Yeah, not all big artists, but you know, a lot of people. And it's funny the things you know, people come up to me, not all the time, but occasionally, and say, Bill, that song that you wrote about and blah, blah, they go on all about it. And it's not about that at all. I mean, they have a whole scenario of how great it is I wrote about it. I just say thanks.
Right.
But it's not. A lot of times they don't know what the song's about, really.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's okay. But songs wind up where they wind up, man. Like I was saying, one of them was on a tombstone, a headstone of some girl in the East Coast that was killed in a car wreck. And it was a country song we wrote that was a number three song called Can I Count On You that McBride and the Ride did, that Ruth and I and Terry McBride in the band wrote. And she said it was her favorite song, and if she ever died, whatever, I want this on my headstone. And she was in a car wreck, I think, a couple of months later. Because Terry was touring with that band, and some people came to the concert and said, hey, and told him the story, and he went and saw it.
Yeah.
Can I Count On You? You know, it was on the headstone and stuff. So, you know, I mean, songs affect people in a strange way. You know, I mean, murder. Maybe even, you know, you never know. But, I mean, Helter Skelter. I mean, but you can look at it like, and of course, that's never the intention. You know, you're just writing a song about something. And people, it's mysterious.
Yeah.
I mean,
so. So did you keep on writing with the Thunderbirds after the... what else did you write with them on their next record, like the crazy?
Nothing.
Nothing.
That was the only song. There were a couple songs they were going to do that I had written, and Ruth and I had written that they were going to do, and then it got. You know, the truth of the matter is that they felt, or Kim or whatever, they just felt they could take it from there.
Yeah,
on their
sure.
own. And so just wrote the songs himself or whatever. And
right.
So be it. But I'd written more stuff for them that would have really been good for them. But,
yeah.
You know, it's all right.
Well, also, I bet there's a, you know, when you're getting into that sort of thing and you're coming into money and you're coming into these kind of, you're kind of like, well, I should probably write the songs. That's where
that happens a lot.
The fucking Bill Carter's over here sitting in Austin at Barton Springs, and I'm out here working in Japan.
Like, yeah. Well, and also sometimes that can be a real career ender because, you know, and I hate to, I mean, but songwriting is much different than playing an instrument, you know, or singing or whatever, in the sense that
you're making something out of nothing.
Yeah. It's not as easy as it looks. I mean, you know, it's a craft to where, and I'm not saying one's easier or harder or better than the other, but there's a lot of people that can sit and really play the guitar, but somebody that can craft a great or a good or a song that works, it takes a lot more cerebral, you know, penetration, you know, to the point where you really have to be disciplined and work really hard and keep your eyes and ears open at all time to take in information and not be satisfied. I'll write a song five times sometimes or a verse or something if it just doesn't feel right. And I think, and so I always say there are songwriters and there's people who write songs. And there's a real difference, you know. I mean, a songwriter is someone that really... There's like a guitar player and guys that play guitar, you know, I mean?
Yeah.
So it's it gets kind of overlooked. Like, I can do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. But, yeah, songwriting's a real, I hate to say it, but it is a little different mindset because it is mental, whereas playing is, you know, just a kind of a real physical thing. I mean, you have to have a soul and spirit and all that. But songwriting is a little different thing
than
the rest of it.
How are you, as a songwriter, do you do it every way you can? Do you sit down and... Like in the case of Willie the Wimp, is there a lot of things you read the paper and get a story and feel something of that? Or do you take it from every... I mean, because you're a very prolific writer and you've been writing for a really long time. And I always... I mean, just as myself as a songwriter, I'm younger than you, not super younger than you, but I mean, I worry like, you know, what, like, what am I going to write about in 5 years? Like, yeah. Where... Am I been saying everything?
Well, there's a lot to write about. I mean, the thing is that what I subconsciously concentrate on, I guess would be the best way to put it, is that I always try and write a song, or one of my main, you know, focuses is writing a song that no one's written a song about, first of all. I mean, because if you do that, you know, then it's the best song, period, of that. It's the only one. You know, or maybe it's the worst one, but at any rate, it's the only one. Yeah. So you're automatically way ahead of the game. If you write a song about Willie the Wimp, people hear that and they go, they want to hear it.
Right.
If you write a song called I Love You, it's like, yeah,
yeah.
I don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, writing songs, I've written a lot of songs about subjects that people have not written about, whether it's a specific person,
right,
name, you know, or place, Jacksboro Highway, you know, Cocktail Waitress at the Poodle Dog Lounge, and my new record, Eva Bible, which was the name I saw on Forensic Files, and I was just passing the TV, and I said, what did that guy say her name was? And this woman's name was Eva Bible, and she was a prostitute, and she was murdered, but she was actually a really kind of good person just doing it out of economically.
Necessity, yeah.
And just the name just killed me. I went, wow.
That's really amazing.
Eva Bible. I went... So I got a little bit of information and then kind of made up a lot of it, but I got the gist of the kind of person she was and just made this song about this person that was kind of forced into this thing and was murdered. And it's kind of it's a hardcore song. I mean, it tells the real story, but things like that. I mean, so, and that's just everyday life. You know, that's stuff that goes on, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. I mean, it's true. And there's stuff every day in every walk of life in the papers, magazines, books, whatever that to write about that no one has yet. And that's,
You keep filling the well, is what you're saying.
I work
coming in.
Well, I work every day. Yeah. I work every single day when I get up writing. I do it every day, you know. And a lot of people don't. And people, hey, I wrote a song. I haven't written a song in 8 months. I go, I've written 30 songs in the last 8 months. I wrote 3 songs this week. They're not great songs, maybe, but sometimes
you wrote songs.
Sometimes you got to write 10 of them to get one, you know, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, or I do. But no, I write all the time. You know, I mean, it's very, like I say, cerebral to the point where it's such a mental kind of focus that once you get on a certain roll with it, it can flow and you can just, you have a mindset and that where you're just, and I've kind of gotten there now to where it's not easier, but it's more fluid.
Well, it's almost like a physical thing. It's almost like running. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you haven't run in 6 months and you go out and run, it's going to be hard.
It's not going to be great.
It's not going to be great. You're not going to get a lot out of it.
It's going to be disappointing.
Yeah. So it is like a muscle almost.
That's right. I mean, and the thing is that now with writing, and also the thing is I finish a song. I don't ever get part. I'm never like, well, I got this song and I'm stuck on it. That never comes out of my mouth because I refuse. I'll write if I have what I think is a good melody and a good idea, I'll write horrible lyrics and then correct them, as opposed to writing one verse that's real good, but I just can't get the rest. I'll write the other 3 or 4 verses or bridge, of course, even if it's bad lyric, and correct it before I'll sit there with a verse that I think is great, because that's just a waste of time. For me, coming back to anything, I won't go back to something after a certain period of time. So I sit, and if I got a whole thing, then it's so much easier to have this thing in front of you. It's like, I don't know if you paint, but painters, you know, when you paint with oils or things, you can correct, you know, you can paint, you can go over stuff and make it better and correct it until it feels right. And you can ruin it by overdoing it, like you can overwrite a song.
Right.
So once you get into what really feels okay, there it's done, you know, to where there's no cringe points. Certain words are like, ah, that word, every time I come to it. Well, if that's the case, get rid of it. You know, don't ever settle for that. And I don't. And I, you know, and I'm not saying all, you know, songs are good, you know, or anything, but it's just such
a whole
good,
songs and you finished
yes,
them.
Yes, it's a great exercise to just to keep you going in the direction to where you're not sitting around with a great chorus and a great verse of this and a bridge here. And it's like, I don't like that at all.
Did you start out as a songwriter that disciplined, or did that come once you started seeing like, oh, this is a, like what happened when I wrote Why Get Up?
Yeah, I mean,
I've got to finish this shit, give it to someone, and go to the next one.
Yeah, I think the thing is that I've always been very disciplined anyway.
Have you?
I've always have been. Yeah, I've always been real, you know, I was real athletic when I was young, and so I was real conscious of, you know, the results you'd get out of something, what you put into it.
Right.
Always knew that, and it's the same with everything. I mean, it's like this tattoo on my arm, you know, the more sweat and peace, the less blood and war. And I believe that to the point of anything you do in life. I mean, it's like if you train as a boxer, train real hard, when you get in the ring, your chances are much better. You're not going to get your ass beat, you know, or whatever. Or you rehearse with a band, you go on stage, it's going to be way better than if you didn't, or you just sort of did. So all that, you know, that plays into everything you do. I mean, the more you write, the better you get at it. Like anything you do, the more you do it, the better you get, even when you don't want to, you know. I never go to the gym, which I still train all the time. I never go to the gym and come home and go, boy, I'm real sorry I did that.
Yeah,
I'm always really glad I did it.
Yeah.
Same with writing a song. I'm glad I got up and wrote this morning. I wrote one of the best songs I think I've ever written.
Yeah.
You know, so it's discipline, man, with, I think, everything you do in life, but in writing, and especially in the arts, because not only is there a lot of competition, but it's really, it takes a real knack and a certain kind of, you know, muse to come up with anything that sparks originality, that has a certain style of your own, you know, without sounding like somebody or whatever. So the more you do it, I think the more you get that.
Sure. That's incredible. That's a good thing to hear from somebody. I think more people need to hear that kind of thing. A lot of people don't talk about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
About not even so much the process, just that you really do have to push yourself a lot to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, maybe musicians get perceived as lazy because there are ones that are lazy that are waiting for something to hit them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know,
there's a lot of aspects of being in the business. I mean, you know, whether it's drugs, alcohol, you know, I never let that affect me. You know, I never let that, you know, take over. I mean, I was always a serious musician. I mean, I always loved music. I always loved playing music, and I never was just like partied, you know, and you know, ignored the craft and art. I mean, I always kept that as the priority. You know, it was never done. I mean, you know, the girls, all the stuff, you know, that comes with it. You know, when you're young, especially.
Yeah.
You know, it was like cool, but I still, even at that, for some reason, I loved it so much. It was always the most important thing, always to me. And you know, I think a lot of kids, I mean, times have just changed, and I get it, you know, but.
Well, there's guys like that with that ethic, you know. Charlie and Will are like that, you know.
Yeah.
I think I'm like that, maybe. I don't know.
Well, you have to be.
I don't know what the hell I am.
I mean, yeah. Well,
But I can see it in other people. You know, you recognize these things, and you mm-hmm. see, you know, that's the most important thing, is to do that well, because that's what you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just nice, because when you're able to actually sit back and look at something that had some success on whatever level. I mean, I look at successes like anyone that records one of my songs, I'm honored. I don't care if it's a guy down the street or, you know, a big artist. I mean, monetarily, it makes a difference. And if it's an artist that you really respect, it's really an honor,
sure.
You know, a tip of the hat. But the fact that your song moved anybody enough to record it is a very, you know, I mean, I'm really honored by that. And to this day, I mean, because like I say, maybe over 200 and some people have recorded my songs, but they're all not huge artists. Some of them are just, I'll get a CD from the East Coast of some girl that recorded some. I mean, that song Richest Man, I think I've got 38 recordings of, one song of mine. And it's and it's mostly girls that do it, and it's called Richest One, right. You know, when they do it. But so it's funny, you know, it's interesting just that, and songs are, for instance, that's a song that's just a song I wrote, the only song I wrote on the piano.
Yeah.
And it's funny, it's the most recorded song, and I think it's a decent song, but for some reason it's the song everyone loves. Everyone loves that song. People that really know about music and people that know nothing about it. And it's just, that's unexplainable.
But isn't that so funny that once you've done it like that, it's out of your control? Because totally. I'm sure in your mind, as soon as that was getting recorded, there have been times when you're like, really? Because I've got these other songs fucking like are awesome.
Oh,
you know, but this is the one that people connect with. There's just some kind of thing in there where... I mean, do you like subconsciously somehow you hit the nail on the head somehow?
Well, that's where you get, you know,
as a communicator.
So exactly. I mean, because songs like, you know what they say, this is a standard. You know, this is a classic, whether it's Proud Mary or whether it's, you know, Yesterday or whatever. But there's not a formula for anything like that. Those songs just happen because of time, place, the right melody, lyric.
That song has that feel. It has that classic.
Well, there's no explanation, you know, other than, and has that feel, but it's like, you can't say what that feel is, you know, or anything. It's just, some songs become that. Most of them don't, but some songs become standard classics, and most don't. And there's no reason why they don't. Everyone would write them, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, but, no, it's interesting. I mean, I mean, that's what I love about songwriting. There's no telling what's going to happen with a song you write. And I have songs that I think are better songs of mine than others.
Yeah.
But that's what I think.
Yeah.
I'll go to a gig and play it, and I'll go, this new song is going to kill them. Yeah. And I'll be like, yeah, that's okay. And then they'll love the one I thought was just kind of a throwaway sort of, it's kind of a nice little ditty. And people, man, that song is great, man. And I go, oh, okay. So I don't go by what I think at all.
Right. I'm terrible at that, you know, too, with other people, too.
Yeah, you can't. You just write them, you put them out there. And
so in the 80s, you started, you had those songs, the songs with the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and then you did some, when did you guys write Crossfire? Was that around that time, after that time?
Latter part of the 80s.
Right. What did you do in between the Why Get Up time? Were you playing more? Were you focusing more on writing and doing that stuff with Ruth?
Yeah. I mean, it was actually not a real good time. You know, I mean, in that time, I mean, until Why Get Up came out and became, they started selling that record, and we got a lump of money from an advertising company that was going to use it but paid us to not let anybody else.
You tell a great story on the PBS thing. I don't want to make you tell it again, but people should watch it because the whole you're not ready to make your red thing and you're ready to move was fantastic.
But anyway, that kind of all happened then, and then kind of right after that was when I started putting together kind of a band of my stuff. And I thought, oh, well, because once Why Get Up got recorded, I realized that I could write songs that could be done by other people and make money. I could make a living doing it. I mean, I proved to myself, because until then, I didn't know if my songs were any good or if I was even capable of doing this. And once I did, I went, okay, now it's up to me. I know I can do it. There's no excuses. It's not just a one-song thing. Now I'm a songwriter. I got to write. I can do this. And then just started getting things recorded like that. And that's it really, getting that song cut made all the difference in the world to my...
It opened the door.
It really did. It opened my mind.
Yeah.
You know, as more so just to let myself know that, okay, man, you can actually, in fact, do this. I mean, I always thought I could, but until something happens, you go, maybe I'm just not that good at it, you know? Yeah. And so that was the thing. And so that's when I started putting a band together and started doing shows around town, Riverfest, and playing at the Coliseum, and the Opry House was still
there. And at
this
point, you're playing bigger gigs because you got a hit song. People know, oh, this is the guy.
And Stevie Dunn, Willie the Wimp, and I toured with him on the East Coast, opening act and stuff, and, you know, different things. And it just became, and then some other people started recording. And, I mean, at the same time, the guy that was playing bass with me, Terry McBride, was a really good country singer and stuff. I said, well, when we get off the road with Stevie, we'll go back and write country songs, man, and stuff. And we wrote all these songs. I took this stuff to Nashville myself. Ruth and I went in and met Tony Brown, the head of MCA at the time. And I said, I just called and said, this is Bill Carter. He didn't know who he was, but he said he'd see me. I went in. Right. He's the biggest guy in Nashville, producer. And
right.
Went in, I played him songs. He went, man, these are really great songs. Who's this guy? I said, well, he's the bass player in my band, but he's a really good country singer. And I think he goes, man, these songs are really good. He goes, I have an idea. He wanted to put his own country band together, Tony, but not be in it, but get the drummer from Vince Gill, the guitar player from Lyle Lovett, and Terry, and make a band, and right. call it McBride and the Ride, and they did, we wrote all the songs. He did all the songs we wrote. We had 3 top 10 hits with it.
Yeah, that the band same, did really well.
One time at the same week, we had number 1 was Crossfire, and number 3 in the country charts. Same week. It was like wow. completely opposite ends of this. I mean, no one's ever like paid much attention to that, but I don't think anyone's ever done that.
No,
I don't think anyone's ever had the number 1 like AOR thing by Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Right, and then also the biggest
number three country song. You know, at the wow. same time. So it was cool because I was really learning that, man, it's legitimate, man. I write country stuff that works. I write this stuff because I'd done all of it. Played in hillbilly bands forever, you know, and I'd played, you know, studied, you know, as far as the history of rock and played in rock bands and done that in the 60s all the way through at the same time. So all this information I took in, I was actually legitimately able to kind of put it back out in my form, yeah, like and it worked.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like you got a doctorate from the School of Hard Knocks. You
exactly.
know what I mean? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, like a living success.
I mean, that's all I've ever done, you know, and once you do something for so long, you're just out of default, you're good at it, you know what I mean? You get to the point where you actually know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of where I am now, and just a lot of good things are coming up now, and I finally decided to kind of go out there, and the response has been amazing. You know, I've been, you know, going out to try and get different gigs and things, and everybody says, yeah, sure, man, he can play. I mean, it's just surprised people know who I am. I was kind of amazed. I call people on the East Coast and say, hey, I got this guy. So, oh, really? That guy, man, yeah, when does he want to play? And I'm like, wow, man, really? I'm flattered, you know, totally by the response of people being so generous, you know.
Yeah, you've got, I can't find the, Unknown. Thank you.
Unknown is the
That's your new album. It just came out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it just came out. Uh-huh.
And you've got a release show coming up at the Continental Club on the 1st, and then like...
I think March 2nd is actually that date.
Oh, okay. Continental. March 2nd. All right. Well, your website lied to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is.
And then you're doing a tour with Charlie and Will Sexton.
Yeah. The three of,
go ahead.
The three of us. Yeah. We're just the three of us. No band or nothing. Just the three of us. Songwriters. Going to do just some, you know... Houston, Dallas, Oklahoma City, San Antonio, Austin, a couple dates. Just do some of that in March.
You're playing all my favorite places in all the cities.
Oh, good.
So,
and I'm doing some other show. I'm doing the awards show at the South by Southwest.
Okay. Are you going to be doing some shows at South by Southwest?
I think that's it. I think just that one. And
that's a good level.
That's a good one, yeah. And there's some other stuff we're doing there that I guess I shouldn't say anything about, but it's, you know, has to do with the awards and stuff. But I'm doing David Letterman next week.
Yeah, that's weeks. What I was waiting for you to say.
2 weeks from today.
Yeah.
Is today Friday?
Today is Friday.
Yeah, 2 weeks from today, 22nd.
How exciting.
David Letterman, I know, man.
I know.
It's so cool because, I mean, I'm a big fan of Letterman. I always watch. I watch it every night. I think he's... I love his thing and everything, and I've been on the show with somebody that was on it, just went there with him, but haven't done my thing, and so this is my thing, man. I mean, I'm playing on David Letterman, so it's really exciting. I love New York, for one thing, but yeah, going there and playing Letterman is like...
Do you, I'm going to ask, because this is weird, now, I had this conversation with Alejandro when he was on here, and a couple of other people, just what a great... place to be, to know that when you stick to what you do and you stay true to your art and to yourself, which I think that you have. I don't see you as trying to be anybody else.
No, that's never.
That's a pretty intense.
I just,
got a pretty strong.
I just do what I do, man. I don't, you know, I just, you know, I can't be anybody else.
But it still pays off, even as you know when you. Not that you think like, oh, well, you know, I might have, you know, done my time as an artist or whatever. Yeah. And never did you think in 2013 that you would be on Letterman.
No.
Did you?
No, I never looked at time as anything. In fact, when they did the documentary on me and stuff, you know, when someone approached me to do it, they were saying, well, man, you know, you've done, I mean, I never looked back and went, man, boy, I've sure done a lot of shit. I mean, it was just like, can I say shit?
Yeah, okay. You can say anything you want.
Okay. And so the thing is that when...
Sorry. My phone.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I'm the host of the show.
Yeah.
And most people, when they turn their phone off when they come in here. Okay, sorry.
That's all right. So, I mean, the thing is that when someone approaches me and says, well, man, you've done so much stuff and know so many people and seen so many changes and all these things that somebody really ought to make a documentary and stuff, and I go, really? I mean, I've just been doing the same thing since I was 13 years old. I never had children, so I never got, you know, chronological age, you know, like, well, now I'm a grandfather and I'm a father. And none of that. I'm just still a guy in bands ever since I'm 13. So, and when people start asking me about stuff, I realize that I have seen a lot. You know, I have been around. I've gone through a lot of different stages of, you know, growth in music and the changes that have been made and different styles of music that I've been through. And I have done a lot, and I've never considered it the kind of thing that I would ever stop doing for any reason, or look back and go, well, I guess I'm done with that. It's just like, I don't know, man. I still got a lot of stuff to do, man. Yeah. I enjoy playing and writing now more than I ever have. I mean, I just love
it. Really shows.
Yeah, I mean, I just love it. I mean, I just love doing it, and I don't have any intention of doing anything else ever.
Good.
I mean, I've been all over the world. You know, I've seen stuff. It's just like, you got to do something.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you just absolutely have to. And why not? You know, I mean, I guess retirement or whatever that word is for people that maybe have done a job they really didn't dig very much
right. Their
whole life. I mean, I guess that's a good thing to get to quit doing it.
Right.
Something like this. I mean, shit. As long as I can still stand, breathe, see, speak or whatever, I mean, I'll just keep doing it.
Yeah. And you have one of those things like, you know, almost like Mac, Ian McLaughlin, where I can see you on CNN playing with Eddie Vedder and Johnny Depp and all these guys, and I can see that same exact artist and musician doing the exact same thing at Zetejas, you know, with Stephen. Like,
yeah.
You're really doing it. You're always in the moment of doing right. It. And I think that's the thing that keeps people fresh.
Yeah.
You know, you never want to become like, no offense, but you don't want to go the route of like a Rod Stewart. You know what I mean? Where you just kind of like, well, I'm an old guy now. I'm going to sing these songs. It's like, there's no more quest for the truth anymore. Like,
you know, yeah.
Trying to find the answer. And guys like Ian, guys like Alejandro, guys like you, guys like Will, guys like Charlie, hopefully me, we're people that will still be looking for an answer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, it's amazing. It's just amazing that just how much more comfortable you get with it.
Yeah.
You go like, man, I'm just really in a groove, man. I can write songs and singing a little better, and it's just fun playing. People really like your stuff. And it gets to where you just don't think of anything else other than you just do it. There's no reason
right.
other than it just feels like that's what you are. That's what you do. It's no trip. It's no trying to write a hit song or trying. You're not trying to do anything. You're just playing. You're just living, playing. You're
in
an artist.
Moment.
You're a musician. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I can play at a little club with 10 people, or I can play, you know, and I played on Willie's Picnics, you know, in front of 150,000 people in a stadium, you know, and I have my preferences. I'd rather be in the Continental Club or something like that. That's more intimate. That's fun. You're right there with the people and all that. And the other thing, you're just a little too separate for me. But, you know, it's all good. You know, I mean, it's all good to do all of it, you know, if you can. But
because what's important is what you're actually doing while you're there.
Oh, yeah. It's got nothing to
making
do with
making the music.
Nothing to do with look at me. I'm famous. Aren't I cool? Yeah. Look at all the money. I mean, it's got nothing to do other than just really giving something to somebody. You know, I mean, it's really just giving something to other humans that they appreciate, love. It means something to them. And that's a great feeling.
Yeah.
That's a great feeling. Just knowing that you're actually giving something to people that don't even know you.
Yeah.
That makes them feel good. I get stuff from all the time, you know, say, man, that song you wrote is just so, it makes me this. And it's like, that's why I do it. You know, that's a lot of why I do it. When I get feedback like that, it's like, that keeps me going, though, that I'm actually doing, giving something back, you know, and helping somebody in some way.
Yeah.
So.
And there's the way that the documentary ends on the PBS documentary, there's a level of gratitude that you express to the audience. Like, it's so heartfelt, you know, the thanks that, you know, like, thank you for this life, you know, thank you for...
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for letting me do this.
Yeah, because they're the boss, you know. I mean, the audience, your audience is your boss. You know, that's they're the ones that, you know, make it able for you to continue.
Yeah.
You know, that they support you. They go, you know, we like what you do so much. We'll buy your stuff and we'll come see you. So it enables you to keep doing it. And I would never, I mean, I've seen people abuse that so many times and I've never understood why. It's a horrible thing, you know, to see any artist abuse the people to come see them, that pay money to come see them or whatever. I mean, I did a show in L.A. a month ago, and these women that came from Brazil, I mean, they came all the way from Brazil to a club. I mean, it's like, brought me these beads, you know. I mean, they're just fans, you know, of like, we brought you these things and stuff. And it's like, man, I mean, it's unbelievable that your music, and that's all, has moved these people so much that they make like a pilgrimage to come pay what would be respect, you know, to you for doing it. And, you know, how can you stop doing it? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no reason to stop. Yeah, I read that on your website. You actually, in your dates page, you wrote, like, was that the show at the Mint?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you thanked everyone for coming out, making it such a special night. You're just like, I'm glad.
I always, when I have the time, I always respond and correspond with everybody because I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, you can tell.
I really do.
Yeah. Well, man, you've done a great. I have such a tremendous amount of respect for you, and I have to say that I'm glad that we were able to sit down.
Oh, me too. Man.
And talk like this, because this is weird. If I would try to talk to you like this at Zitejas, you'd be like,
"Yeah, what?" That doesn't. You know.
So, but when I met you was I lived in Houston. I moved here like in the early 90s, like 1991 or something. I lived at the Congress House. I don't know if you remember this, but you and Ruth came. I can't remember if you were writing with someone there for a few days or working on something there.
I don't know.
And I was so intimidated by you. Like, I remember being like, oh, man, guys, I don't even know what to say. I don't want to say the wrong things. You're very cool. And everyone, I remember, like, I think Hallman asked me to vacuum. I do. Yeah, he did. Hey, man, this, you know, Ruth and Bill are coming over. So, like, gotta clean the place up. Let's get some coffee going or something. Make this place look good. And so then I was kind of, like, anticipating. But there was this confidence and just sort of, like, I didn't get your sarcasm at first. I was really scared. Like, I was like, this guy's like a tough guy. With all this, like, does really well. But I'm really glad that I've gotten to see you over the years.
Oh, thanks,
and,
man.
And I'm not a pussy. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, hey, man. I a lot of people kind of, you know, I don't know, man. I guess it's just because I try and just be honest with people, you know. And sometimes I guess that comes off like hardcore somehow. But, you know, I just like to speak the truth of what I think, you know, about people and things.
I like,
you know,
that about you.
And, you know, I mean, I think it's a certain thing you have to do for yourself, you know. I mean, otherwise you can get caught up, you know, going places you shouldn't, maybe, for your own sanity.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
So people can find all your stuff at BillCarterAndTheBlame.com?
Well, there's BillCarterAndTheBlame.com. There's UnisonMusic.com, which is my record company.
Okay.
In Los Angeles. And I have a Bill Carter and the Blame fan page on Facebook, which is a good source of where you can find out everything.
Okay.
In town, Waterloo is always the place. You can get all my stuff on iTunes. You know, all the places you can. It's pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
You know.
And pick up Unknown. It's a really great album.
Unknown, yeah, it's the new one. I'm real excited about this one, man.
Who produced that?
I did. I wrote, arranged, and produced it all. I played like 10 instruments, so I did a lot on that record.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was big fun for me.
Well, it's a great record.
Thanks.
You know when you're going to do your next one? No plans yet.
I've got plenty of stuff written. I mean, I've probably got a full 3 more records written at this point.
Yeah,
I write a lot. I'm anxious to start on another one.
Yeah.
I'm even doing some songs live that have never been recorded.
Awesome.
Already. Yeah. I'm always on, you know, songs I'm always on. I'm always ready for the next one, you know. I'm always ready for the next song. So I write a lot and yeah.
Yeah, pick up Unknown and I guess 2 weeks. What's the date of the Letterman show?
February 22nd. Okay. That would be 2 weeks from today.
2 weeks from today on David Letterman. Watch him. Get caught up. Go see the PBS documentary. I think I found it on Vimeo.
Yeah, it's called Arts in Context.
Arts in Context. Yeah. Thank you. That's good.
It's a show. Yeah, that's a day on PBS. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you, my friend. Sorry, I appreciate it. It's been a great time.
Very nice. Bye. Yeah. Bill Carter, man, that was great. I loved having that conversation with him. I got a call later that day from a mutual friend of ours, this guy Matt McCormick, who's going to be on the show in a couple weeks. He said that Bill had a great time. That makes me feel so good, because I know that guys like that have done a lot of interviews, and it means a lot to know that it was a good time, because I like to have a good time. I like the guests to have a good time. Having someone like Bill say that he had a good time makes me feel great. So thanks, Bill. Thanks for coming on my show. Makes the show better. We're all better for this, hopefully. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you got something out of it. And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. Like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Follow me on Twitter and on Instagram. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. And let's enjoy a little bit more Bill Carter. Here's the song Eva Bible that he was talking about. One of the songs he talked about on the show. So thank you, Bill. And enjoy this music. Buy this album. Do it.
Eva Bible was a street gal. She walked them all night long. Eva Bible was a street gal. She walked them till the dawn. Sunday, kneel down and pray. Eva Bible, murdered on Mother's Day. Until the dawn.